Last time we spoke about the invasion of the Admiralty Islands and some action on New Britain and Bougainville. The last steps of Operation Cartwheel would see the Bismarck-Solomon area sealed off with the capture of the Admiralty Islands. General MacArthur was yet again trying to seize the initiative and force a drive upon the Philippines. A diversionary landing was made against Momot and Los Negros that would cost 116 lives, 434 wounded by March 8th. Over on New Britain, General Rupertus began new amphibious assaults and other actions to try and cut off the retreat of the Japanese defenders. Then over on Bougainville, under immense pressure from his superiors, General Hayakatake prepared to launch his main counterattack, codenamed Operation TA. He assembled 15,000 men who would hit the American defensive perimeter to try and dislodge the enemy from the island. Yet, was this idea even feasible? Or would it all end in a terrific disaster? This episode is The Battle of Imphal. Welcome back to the Pacific War Podcast week by week. I'm your dutiful host, Greg Watson. Before we begin, I just want to remind you all that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Perhaps you want to learn a bit more about World War II? Kings and Generals is an assortment of episodes on World War II and so much more, so go give them a look over at YouTube. So please subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, The Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that you are still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, The Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. Over there I've just released part 3 in my General Ishiwara Kanji series, this one titled The China War. That series, by the way, used to be an exclusive on my Patreon account, which can be found at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel. Over there, you can find more than 14 plus and ongoing exclusive Patreon podcasts, built off subjects that my Patreons want to hear more about. Starting at just $2 a month, you get the exclusive podcasts and other goodies. Check it out. It means a lot to me. The war was not going well for the Japanese by 1944. They were on the cusp of being dislodged from the South Pacific. Rabaul and Truk were effectively neutralized, and the Americans were now making enormous strides in the Central Pacific, seen in the Gilberts and Marshall campaigns. Even within Burma, a war front the Japanese had basically been winning every battle flawlessly, was now suffering defeats. The first defeats were found in the Hukwang Valley and the Arakan region. In the face of these terrible defeats, the Japanese sought an answer. And General Mutaguchi argued he had the answer. General Mutaguchi, a victor over the Singapore campaign, had wargamed the possibility of invading India, and he won the support of some of his supporters in Tokyo. His reasoning had been to brush past the British in Assam and then to storm the gateway into the subcontinent, where hopefully the Indians would rise up to greet the Japanese as liberators. With Subhas Chandra Bose and his Indian National Army, the Japanese could rally the Indians to turn against the British. The collapse of India would be a killing blow against Britain's influence in Asia. Initially, it was also believed such a move would allow the Japanese to link up with their Axis allies in perhaps Persia. Such fantastical ideas were far-fetched even for 1942 standards. But in 1944, they were laughable. The Battle of Stalingrad and Kursk had effectively turned the Eastern Front completely around. The Germans were now fighting for their very survival. Yet, this did not at all dissuade Mutaguchi. Lieutenant General Hanaya Tadashi was placed in charge of the Arakan region. Hanaya was tasked with deceiving the British into believing the counterattack in the Arakan region was an attempt to invade India, thus dragging units out of Imphal. This operation was codenamed Hago, an intended feint, to mask another operation, Yugo, to invade Imphal. To pull it off, the assault in the Arakan region was to be made massive. General Slim was forced to meet the enemy fiercely in the Arakan region. He had no choice but to pull his reserves out of Imphal. The Japanese were delivered a nasty surprise with the admin box tactic. For over 18 days, the battle raged around the admin box, but the Japanese could not make a dent. The Japanese forces had expected, once the British saw their lines of communications cut, and that they were outflanked, they would simply panic and flee, which was the norm in Burma. It was, after all, what had been occurring for years in Burma by this point. The Japanese hoped to annihilate the 15th Corps, but instead, the British dug in their heels. Once again, victory disease sprang its ugly head. The arrogant, overly confident Japanese bit off more than they could chew. It was as if they were facing a brand new opponent. The admin box was hit by infantry and aerial attacks. The casualties were terrific. But the admin box never wavered. The Japanese had planned for a lightning battle, traveling light and seizing supplies on the go. But the British did not roll over easy. The Japanese began to run out of supplies. Starvation loomed over the invaders. Casualties on both sides increased sharply, and Slim predicted the Japanese would not allow for defeat and instead would just redouble their efforts. By February the 13th, Slim was confident victory was in their hands as the 26th Indian Division began to arrive to deliver a hammer blow, with the anvil box being the anvil. The Japanese fought desperately, but by the 24th, they were withdrawing, leaving 5,000 dead behind them. After defeating the Japanese, Slim unleashed his own operation into Arakan, and while doing so, his men captured some Japanese documents showcasing Operation Hago in full. Now Slim knew the Japanese were feinting him to draw resources away from Imphal. Now Mutoguchi had sold Operation Yugo to his superiors in Tokyo as a preemptive strike to disable the 14th Army, but in reality, it was always to invade India. He also wanted to press his attack further and take Dimapur, a major supply base through which the railway line to Lido ran. Taking Dimapur would deal a major blow to the Allies and could potentially open a door to further operations deeper into India. Once they had broken through, the INA would rally local support, enabling them to extend the fight to the British in Assam, Bengal, and beyond. For his Operation Yugo, Mutoguchi thought he could outsmart the British in terms of how he would approach Imphal. His plan called for the 33rd Division of Lieutenant General Yanagida Motoso to begin an advance on March the 8th, attacking from the south. It was presumed the British would expect this and rush reinforcements when attacked. Meanwhile, he planned to send the 15th Division under Lieutenant General Yamachi Masafumi a week later to ford the Chinwin River and to advance on Imphal from the north. Even further north, the entire 31st Division of Lieutenant General Seito Kotoko would also ford the Chinwin between the Homolin and Tamathi, advancing northwest to block the main British supply route in the hills of Kohima. To pull all of this off, Mutoguchi needed to ensure his forces captured Imphal before the monsoon rains made the jungle tracks impassable. He did not have much in terms of supplies to give to his three divisions. By 1943, the supply route into Rangoon by sea through the Bay of Bengal had become too dangerous because of Allied submarine attacks, so the supplies had to rely on the railway being constructed by forced labor and POWs from Thailand. Mutoguchi was well aware of these issues. He knew, however, from personal experience in Malaya and Singapore, that taking logistical risks against the British could bring great rewards. This, of course, was because the British, who were usually immeasurably better supplied than the Japanese, frequently left behind large quantities of what the later would refer to as Tachiro Kiyoyo, Churchill rations, in their haste to flee the advancing Japanese. Accordingly, the capture of the British supply dumps around Imphal formed a key assumption in his planning. The essence of Mutoguchi's plan was speed, Tatsutsubin, swift onslaught. For if these vast depots were not seized as a matter of priority, the whole offensive would literally run out of fuel. He thought it would take no more than 3 weeks for his forces to fall on the British supply dumps. Without the capture of these supplies, success could not be guaranteed, but it seemed increasingly inconceivable to Mutoguchi that a decisive, overwhelming attack against Imphal would not bring with it rapid and substantial rewards. At no time was he concerned that he might not capture the vast British depots needed to fuel his advance. Imphal needed to be taken by April the 10th, or it would all fall to ruin. General Slim planned for his 14th Army to make a stand at Imphal, taking the hit on the chin, as they say, before pushing the enemy back. He needed to draw the Japanese into the Imphal Valley in a tight little circle so he could launch an effective counteroffensive. Lieutenant General Joffrey Schoon's 4th Corps would deploy the 20th Indian Division, led by Major General Douglas Gracie, around Temu, and the 17th Indian Light Division of Major General David Punch Cohen around Tidim. Both divisions had been aggressively carrying out patrols in the valley and along the banks of the Chinwin River. The 23rd Indian Division of Major General Overy Roberts was held in reserve at Imphal, with his 49th Brigade in the Okhrul area to the northeast. Once Mutaguchi's offensive kicked off, Slim planned for his two southern divisions to withdraw up the Tamupalel and Tidim roads to go on the defensive around the Imphal Valley. The two divisions would have a short and more secure line of communications and supply behind them as they forced the Japanese to extend themselves over the mountains. To counter losing the overland supply line from Kohima, Slim planned to use air supply to maintain his men during the long siege. Slim also expected Mutaguchi to send a single regiment to seize the defensiveless Kohima, not an entire division, that was further tasked with pouring down into the Brahmaputra Valley. The last part would put his entire plan into jeopardy. On March the 8th, Operation Yugo was kicked off with Lieutenant General Yanagida Motoso's 33rd Division beginning their advance in four columns. The left column was the 215th Regiment led by Colonel Sasahara Masahiko, who advanced south of Tidim before swinging north towards the village of Singel. They would come across the large supply depot between the milestones 109 and 110 around the Tidim Road. The central column consisted of the 214th Regiment led by Colonel Sakuma Takeyoshi, advancing up the Kabao Valley to assault Tonzang. Following this column up was the Fort White Garrison Unit led by Colonel Yagishiguro. Both columns would cut off the route of withdrawal of Major General David Cohen's 17th Division and try to annihilate it. Lastly, the right column consisting of the Yamamoto Force was led by Major General Yamamoto Susanoro. They would be advancing north up the Kabao Valley to assault Major General Douglas Gracie's 20th Division on the Tamupalel Road. There had been early reports from scouts that groups of Japanese soldiers were advancing west of the Tidim Road. This only sounded off the alarm bells for the 14th Corps on March the 12th, after a verified sighting report was made stating a large group of Japanese were just a few kilometers off the road at milestone 109. Consequently, Schoons ordered Cohen to withdraw, so the 17th would begin to move from Tidim on March the 14th, after laying mines and some booby traps. But it was too late, as the Japanese had already cut the Tidim Road earlier that morning, so Cohen would have to fight his way out to Imphal. That same day, Yamamoto Force had already started attacking Gracie's southern frontline positions, with a particular tank-on-tank battle developing between a troop of M3 Lee Grant tanks of the 3rd Carabiniers and some light tanks of the 14th Tank Regiment. The latter were trounced in the end, with four tanks destroyed and two captured. Meanwhile, on the 15th, Lieutenant General Yamachi Masafumi's 15th Division began fording the Chinwin River at Thong Dut and Sitang, and they would descend upon Imphal from the north. Lieutenant General Saito Kotoku's 31st Division also forded the river further north at Komalin, Kauya, and Tamanthi, and they were rapidly advancing towards Kohima and Ukril. Just as Mutaguchi had guessed, Schoons ordered his 37th and 49th Brigades to advance to the Tidim Road to help Cohen's men. Cohen had sent his 63rd Indian Brigade to attack the 214th Regiment at Tonang and Titum. They left Imphal and Ukril with little protection, so Schoons decided to dispatch the newly arrived 50th Indian Parachute Brigade of Brigadier Maxwell Hope Thompson to defend Ukril, but he did not expect them to find a real fight. Ukril would only have the lightest of garrisons and no real defenses. Forces in the area comprised two battalions of the newly raised and partly trained 50th Indian Parachute Brigade, whose young and professional commander, the 31-year-old Brigadier Maxwell Tim Hope Thomas, had persuaded the powers that be in New Delhi to allow him to complete the training of his brigade in territory close to the enemy. At the start of March, the brigade HQ and one battalion had arrived at Imphal and began the leisurely process of shaking itself out in the safety of the hills northeast of the town. To this brigade was added the 4th and 5th Marathas under Lieutenant Colonel Trim. Sent into the jungle almost to fend for themselves, it was not expected that they would actually have to fight, let alone be on the receiving end of an entire Japanese divisional attack. They had little equipment, no barbed wire, and little or no experience or knowledge of the territory. On March the 16th, Schoons ordered Gracie to withdraw so the 20th Division could begin a controlled withdrawal up the Tamupalal Road, gradually moving into three defensive boxes. The first box was to be at Moray, held by the 32nd Indian Brigade. The second in the Konkang Sibong area, held by the 80th Indian Brigade. The third was to be on the Shinam Saddle, held by the 100th Indian Brigade. Luckily for the Allies, Yamamoto had dispatched two of his battalions in a useless wide flanking maneuver towards Mambi and the Tamupalal Road. Thus, Yamamoto would lack sufficient troops to launch a full-on attack against the retreating Allied forces. Meanwhile, Hawker Hurricanes and heavy artillery bombarded as the 63rd launched a direct assault against the Titum Saddle, managing to break through the Manipur River, leaving a rearguard at the bridge. During the following days, the rearguard would repel a series of intense assaults upon the saddle by the 214th Regiment and Yanagida's Fort White Column. At the same time, the 37th Brigade was fighting against the bulk of the 215th Regiment around Milestone 100. The fighting became very confused as the Japanese units became sandwiched between the Allied units, who in turn were surrounded by even more Japanese units. On March the 18th, the 3rd Battalion, 215th Regiment, managed to capture a supply depot between Milestones 1 and 9 and 110, facing just minor resistance. Then they were forced to repel a number of counterattacks by the 48th Indian Brigade. On the 19th, Hope Thompson received some panicked reports that his battalions were seeing heavy columns of Japanese advancing on their undefended camp at Sheldon's Corner. It was the 31st Infantry of Major General Miyazaki Shigesaburo from the 58th Regiment. Hope Thompson made a last-minute call to assemble his dispersed forces at the deserted Naga village of Sangshak. His brigade, when concentrated, consisted of 1,850 men. However, as the troops dug in, they discovered to their discomfort that they were atop an ancient volcano, and the rock was impervious to their little picks. All they could dig were shallow trenches, which provided ineffective protection from Japanese artillery. Like most Naga villages at Sangshak, they were perched on a hill and had no water. Anything the men required had to be brought up from the valley floor, through a rapidly tightening Japanese encirclement. It's unknown why Miyazaki diverted his men to hit Sangshak rather than continue towards Kohima. By nightfall of the 22nd, the Japanese infantry overwhelmed the Indian defenses without performing a detailed reconnaissance and lacking any artillery support. This would prove to be a fatal mistake. 400 Gurkhas of the 153rd Parachute Battalion began mowing down wave after wave of Japanese troops using machine gun fire. The Japanese 8th Company of the 58th lost 90 out of 120 men in the space of just 15 minutes. Suffering tremendous casualties, seeing entire companies decimated, Miyazaki decided to regroup and began tossing numerous frantic efforts to break up the defenders' positions. Under heavy mountain artillery fire and unable to be supplied by air, Hope Thompson's troops grimly held a position that was not even ringed by barbed wire until March the 26th. When they finally received Schoon's order to pull out. The parachute brigade was being virtually destroyed in four battles at Sangshank, suffering 652 casualties. Yet in turn, Miyazaki was served nearly 1,000 casualties, and his advance upon Kohima was held up for more than a week, severely delaying Sato's plans. Further to the south, Yamashi's 60th Regiment was also facing stubborn defenses at Sangshank. They actually had been waiting for a battle at Sangshak to conclude and only jumped in at the last day's assault. This prevented one of Yamachi's columns from arriving in time north of Imphal, giving Schoons and Slim an extra few days to prepare Imphal's defenses. Meanwhile, on March the 23rd, the 48th Brigade used their heavy guns and mortars to hit the Japanese positions and managed to force the 215th Regiment to pull away from the valuable supply depot. To secure the depot, however, they still needed to clear the road from the north. Gurkhas were sent in waves against the strongly defended Japanese bunkers, while the 37th Brigade and Hawker Hurricanes hit the main defensive positions of the 215th Regiment. At this point, General Yanagida, who had always felt that the Allied capabilities were being underestimated, determined that his forces would not be able to hold on much longer, and thus he ordered them to pull back. Yanagida had received a signal from Colonel Sasahara about the critical situation his regiment was in. Sasahara, in turn, had been reacting to a signal from one of his battalion commanders, Major Suiki. faced with rapidly depleting ammunition, mounting casualties, and attacks on his position near Milestone 109, Major Suki had signaled that he would not be able to hold on much longer. He indicated that he would destroy his codes and radio and try to fight to the end. Sasahara is said to have communicated this and the regiment's resolve to fight to the end to Yanagida. There is some mystery around the signal. Some accounts suggest the divisional commander received only the latter half of the message. Either way, Yanagida had had enough. All of his reservations about the Impala offensive came to the forefront. He ordered the 215th Regiment to pull out, and he sent a signal to Mutaguchi about his decision. In this, he noted the strength of their opponent, questioned the rationale of the entire operation, and remarked on the impossibility of meeting the deadline. He is supposed to have gone as far as to suggest the suspension of the Impala offensive altogether. This, as you can imagine, greatly pissed off Mutaguchi, whose divisional commanders, for the majority, disagreed with his Yugo plan. In fact, Yanagida had openly derided him as an imbecile. Irregardless, Mutaguchi sought to remove Yanagida from his command. Their relationship would not improve, as more setbacks were on the way. With the Japanese dislodged, the 37th Brigade managed to reopen the Tidim Road, and the 48th Brigade finally secured the entire depot area around Milestone 109. Whatever supplies that could be recovered and transported back to Impal were grabbed. And for the rest, it was all destroyed so the Japanese could not have it. On the 26th, the 63rd Brigade's rearguard also withdrew, blowing up the Manipur River Bridge behind them. 2 days later, the 37th made first contact with Cohen's units near Milestone 102, and the 17th Division finally began their retreat towards Impal. Their only obstacle would be a roadblock established by the 2nd Battalion, 213th Regiment, around Kadam. But that would be cleared out quite easily by Cohen's men, who were able to reach Impal by April the 4th. In the meantime, Skunzen asked Gracie to send back units of his 100th Indian Brigade into the reserve on the 25th, leaving him with only two brigades to fend off the Japanese attacks. The next day, the 11th Company, 213th Regiment of the Yamamoto Force, managed to advance past the main defenses at Moray, defended by the 32nd Indian Brigade, and they captured the Nippon Hill. Though they were under heavy enemy pressure, the 32nd Indian Brigade finally withdrew from Moray on April the 1st. They set the dump on fire, and by some estimates, at least £1 million worth of supplies that had not yet been evacuated were destroyed. They arrived at the Shinam Saddle a few days later to join the 80th Indian Brigade in a fierce battle for the Nippon Hill. Meanwhile, Slim had foreseen that reinforcements would be needed at Impal and Kohima, and he had already requested them with great urgency. Slim was granted 30 Dakotas to fly the 5th Division from Arakan back on the 18th. By the 27th, the 9th and 123rd Indian Brigades had arrived at Impal, and the 161st Indian Brigade was being flown to Dimapur to reinforce Kohima. In addition, Slim was promised the 2nd British Division and the 23rd Long Range Penetration Brigade should it be necessary. General Gifford also decided that once the airlift of the 5th Division was complete, the 7th Division would then be airlifted to Manipur. Yet that is going to be all for the India-Burma front, as we now need to move over to New Britain. On March the 5th, Colonel Smith's 5th Marines began loading for an overnight run to the Willamese Peninsula, departing Iboki by nightfall. The following morning, the small convoy assembled off Vulapai, waiting for air support to soften up the landing area, but they never showed up. Apparently having reason to believe that the Marines would attempt to land at Beach Red, the defenders constructed an intricate communications net between Talisi and Vulapai, placing some mines on the beach, constructed defenses of some sorts, sighted in 90mm mortars, and then inexplicably did not attempt to defend the beach as they could have done very well under the circumstances. Realizing the longer they waited, the better the enemy could prepare, Smith ordered the first assault wave to hit the beaches at 8:25 a.m. LCM tank gunboats raked the beach with machine gun fire, as Smith's 1st Battalion successfully landed, meeting enemy sniper and mortar fire. Some sniper fire was observed, and 90mm mortar shells began splashing in the water, but Companies A and B drove on shoreward, and within 10 minutes, after crossing the line of departure, about 500 Marines had landed. The two assault companies then pushed forward to establish a beachhead line through which the 2nd Battalion could pass and continue the attack in the direction of the Bidokara mission. Company A accomplished this with relatively little difficulty on the right, But over on the left, there existed a virtually impassable swamp, running north and south and extending to the edge of the Volopai track. As a result of this, Company B had to pass through a slot between Little Mount Wari and the swamp in order to accomplish its mission, encountering and eliminating an enemy pocket of resistance before establishing its line 200 yards inland. Meanwhile, the reinforced platoon patrol that had gone after the bunker on Little Mount Wari had run into some difficulties. The retreating enemy had joined other of their comrades and hastily manned defensive positions which had been prepared in the Volopai Coconut Grove. The platoon accounted for about a dozen of the Emperor's troops, losing one Marine killed and another wounded in the process. Finding he could not advance against the Japanese, all-around defensive positions, the patrol leader requested assistance but was instructed to hold what he had until the 2nd Battalion arrived to the scene. As the advancing elements pushed their way through the coconut trees, rear echelon personnel on Beach Red suffered heavier casualties than the assault units. All during the day, the Japanese had lobbed 90mm mortar shells onto the beach, shells landing capriciously and inevitably taking their toll in the crowded, constricted area. Among some of the early victims was Lieutenant Commander Richard Forsyth, regimental surgeon, who continued working with the wounded until he was evacuated. The heaviest casualties that day were recorded in the 11th Marines and among medical company personnel. Both groups had to remain on the beach, there being no other place to go. On top of that, coral reefs were delaying the LCMs from fully landing the 3rd Battalion until early afternoon. Once Company E came ashore, the advance guard rapidly moved forward and began moving through the 1st Battalion's lines astride the Volopai Plantation track at 11 a.m. The Marines were brought to an abrupt halt 200 yards farther on, where the Japanese had dug positions commanding the narrow trail. As Company E attempted to attack outside the plantation track, a medium tank commanded by Lieutenant John Scarborough moved up the trail to the company's assistance, and he knocked out a heavy machine gun position. But suddenly two Japanese, one on each side of the trail and each armed with a magnetic mine, leaped out of the brush. The defending Marine infantry killed one before he could reach the tank, but the other succeeded in affixing the mine to the port side of the turret. The blast that followed killed the Japanese and the Marine who was trying to stop him, as well as jamming the turret so it could not be operated, and stunned the tank crew within. Simultaneously, the rear of the turret was pierced by a missile, presumably an anti-tank grenade, which made a hole about 3/4 of an inch in diameter. Supported by two more tanks and mortars, Company E finally began moving towards the Coconut Grove, with increasing momentum during the afternoon, at the same time capturing a detailed map of a Japanese position in the Talisi-Bitokara-Waru area. As night approached, elements of the 2nd Battalion set up all-around defense within the Coconut Grove while the 1st Battalion manned the beachhead. By the end of the first day, the Marines had penetrated approximately 2,000 yards inland from the beach and killed 35 Japanese while suffering 13 killed and 71 wounded, most of them to deadly mortar fire. More than half of these were incurred on the beach, and the figures for the day represented more than half the total casualties the combat team would suffer between March the 6th and its departure on April the 25th. 9 of the fatalities and 29 of the wounded were with the 11th Marines alone. At 2 a.m. on March the 7th, a handful of Japanese attempted to infiltrate the lines of Company E, but the attack was so easily repelled that Smith considered that this wasn't even a counterattack. Actually, realizing that his forces were heavily outnumbered, General Sakai had ordered the defenders to leave a rearguard of about 100 men and withdraw at once towards Bola. During that morning, the 2nd Battalion advanced through the abandoned enemy positions without facing any opposition until they were stopped at Mount Schluthers, northwest slope at 11:45 a.m. It became evident that the Japanese were attempting to turn the battalion's right flank. Luckily, Company F rushed forward and managed to extend the threatened flank and seize the high ground. At 3 p.m., the reserve 3rd Battalion was also landed at Volopai, thus relieving the 1st Battalion at the beachhead. The next morning after the mortar barrage, the 2nd Battalion soon discovered the Japanese had retreated past Bitokara. The Marines quickly captured Bitokara by 1:40 p.m., Now the Marines had dispatched scouts towards Mount Sleuther and Talisi. The Mount Sleuther scouting group reported that the Japanese were well dug on a nearby peak, and at 3 p.m. a task force consisting of Company E and some reinforcing elements began the ascent. A request for artillery fire on Sleuther brought several rounds dangerously close to the 2nd Battalion 5th Marine CP, and the battalion's 81mm mortars promptly took over the support mission. As the task force approached the enemy positions, however, it ran into concentrated fire from machine guns and small arms, backed up by 90mm mortar and 75mm field pieces. The Marines fought back for over an hour and sustained 18 casualties before they were ordered to withdraw to the mission. The 2nd Scouting Party had returned from Talisi, meanwhile, to report no indications of any enemy. As no enemy presence was found on the later, Company F advanced to the aerodrome and in less than an hour reported it secured. Meanwhile, the 1st Battalion advanced to La Po and then began to push over rough terrain towards Waru, finally digging in for the night just a bit short of their objective. After some artillery and mortar dueling during the night, Companies G, B, and C launched a coordinated assault at 8 a.m. on the 9th. Once again, they found abandoned positions, successfully clearing the Waru area by 1 p.m. Also, a patrol was landed on Garo Island at 11:47 a.m., reporting it deserted as well. By the afternoon, Smith moved his command post to Bidukara and informed the division that Talisi was secure and that his forces would now concentrate on mopping up and patrolling the Willamese Peninsula. The 4-day campaign had cost the Marines 17 deaths and 114 wounded, while estimating they had killed 150 Japanese. But now, to finish off this episode, we're going to need to go over to Bougainville. The Japanese had begun earlier in the year to improve some trails, particularly the net leading from the Mozegedi-Mararaka area. A rough road had been completed through the jungle to the jump-off positions for the infantry. Nevertheless, the movement of over 15,000 troops with all of their equipment proved to be a major task that would have dampened the spirits of all but the most ardent of warriors. Artillery units had a particularly difficult time pulling their heavy guns through the jungle to get them into position to support the attack. Their task was made even more difficult by the daily downpour that flooded the streams, washing away many of the makeshift bridges, making some of the trails veritable seas of mud. American intelligence by mid-February was aware of the large-scale movement towards the perimeter, and Allied planes repeatedly attacked the trails. Despite all of these difficulties, the Japanese soldiers displayed their tenacity and their ability to overcome the most difficult obstacles, brought up all of their supplies, and eventually had all of their guns in place for the grand attack. All of this was done to support a major counteroffensive scheduled to begin on March the 8th. On the 7th, the Owasa unit had assembled behind Hill 1111, the Magata unit behind Mount Nampei, the Muda unit at Pico Village on the east-west trail, and the 17th Army Artillery Group, commanded by Colonel Seito Harumasa, in place on Hill 600. Facing them, of course, were men of the 37th American Divisions, who were on full alert in their foxholes and bunkers, waiting for the great Japanese counterattack. On the 8th, General Hayakatake's counterattack began with a heavy, albeit uncoordinated artillery bombardment. The Japanese artillery concentrated its fire on Piva Yoke, instead of the forward areas of the perimeter, which would be the main initial point of the attack. The artillery fire was delivered spasmodically and was in poor coordination despite the high vantage points from which the Japanese surveyed the central segment of the American positions. The Japanese artillery did very little damage. American Corps and Divisional Artillery countered immediately, the 37th Division guns firing on the suspected hills to the northeast and the American howitzers concentrating on those to the east. The 6th Field Artillery Battalion and the 129th Infantry's Cannon Company were so situated that they could fire directly at the gun flashes. All of their guns were directed by forward observers or spotter planes. Destroyers in Empress Augusta Bay also fired counter-battery missions. By mid-morning, marine dive and torpedo bombers were flying neutralization missions against Hills 250 and 600. Then in the afternoon, 56 Dauntless and 36 Avengers, guided by artillery smoke shells, struck the main concentrations around Hill 1111. This all massively delayed the Japanese main assault. Only the 23rd Regiment would manage to assemble in place for the attack on Hill 700 by nightfall. Under drenching rainfall, the Japanese thus attacked the hill with some companies, yet their first assault was easily repelled by the experienced defenders. At 2:30, General Iwasa launched his main assault, sending his 2nd and 3rd Battalions, 23rd Division, against the saddle. Despite the heavy fire from the 145th Regiment, the Japanese stormed the hill en masse, screaming threats in English and even singing American songs, presumably in attempts to unnerve the defenders upon the hill. According to a historian of the 145th, "The enemy stormed the hill, clawing his way up the steep slope. yelling like a maniac, suicidally putting everything he had into a frontal attack designed to take the highest point on the hill. The 145th Infantry defending the ridge were somewhat taken aback by an enemy so unreasoning as to crawl up the 70-degree slope on all fours, rifles slung over their backs. Suffering severe losses, USA 2nd Battalion managed to blast their way through the protective wire and knock out some of the pillboxes. Through this gap, the Japanese moved onto the saddle and began to attack adjacent strong points, securing a penetration of the 145th's line 70 yards wide and 50 yards deep. Behind them, however, an effective artillery response would break up the attack of OSA's 3rd Battalion. Yet the 2nd Battalion would continue to expand this perimeter until, by 12 o'clock, they had captured 7 pillboxes and had brought up machine guns and mortars with which they could put McClelland Road, the only lateral supply road for the 145th, under direct fire. Supply of the forward troops became very difficult since the 3/4-ton trucks and half-tracks could not use the road. All the supplies had to be hand-carried. Evacuation of the wounded also became quite difficult and dangerous. Japanese machine guns on the crest of the hill were able to cover the ridge with accurate and deadly grazing fire. They had placed other machine guns in trees on the spur of the hill, about 100 yards to the rear of the ground-emplaced weapons, which could sweep the entire front. With the exception of a few scattered trees and shallow trenches, there was little cover for the troops of the 145th, who moved up the steep slopes attempting to retake the lost positions. While during the day, the Japanese were also extending the trenches, repairing the old pillboxes and building new ones. In response to this breakthrough, General Beitler sent the 1st Battalion 145th Regiment to counterattack. By noon, the Americans were attacking the newly gained Japanese positions, successfully retaking 5 of the lost pillboxes against heavy fire and establishing a new line just south of the crest by nightfall. The first attempt to recapture Hill 700 was launched at noon on the 9th. Company C moved northward against the saddle in a direct frontal assault while two platoons of Company F attacked the saddle from the flanks. Company C was halted by devastating fire 2/3 of the way to its objective, and the men were forced to dig in and hold what they had gained. Meanwhile, the riflemen of Company F had retaken 5 of the lost pillboxes, and the line, now reinforced, was solidly established by nightfall just south of the crest. Beitler had ordered 2 tanks forward late in the afternoon to take enemy targets under direct fire, particularly those that menaced McClellan's Road, but the terrain proved too steep for them to be used effectively. Thankfully, Iwasa's breakthrough had been contained, with the 145th losing 23 killed, 128 wounded, against an estimated 500 dead Japanese. I would like to take this time to remind all of you that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Please go subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, The Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that you are still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, The Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. Over there, I've just released the 3rd part in my series on General Kanji Ishiwara, this one titled The China War. That series used to be an exclusive on my Patreon account, which can be found at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel. And over there, at just $2 or more, you can get full access to over 14 plus ongoing exclusive Patreon podcasts. So come over and check it out. Muraguchi's insane Operation Yugo was not going the way he thought it would. General Slim was outsmarting his enemy, and it seems the Allies were going to make further gains in the Burma front. Meanwhile, things were really heating up on Bougainville as General Hayakatake continued his grand counter-offensive.